Larry Schweiger has been part of some big moments in environmental history. In his 40-year career, he was president and CEO of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy, the National Wildlife Federation, and Penn Future. Schweiger worked on successful legislation during the George H.W. Bush administration with the late Senator John Hines to curb acid rain by reaching across the aisle.
Today, there are so many wedges being driven between the parties, and I think they're intentional wedges being driven to prevent the parties from getting together, from moving the solutions forward.
And he sees a more complicated path to coming up with climate change solutions. I sat down with Larry Schweiger recently to talk about his new book, The Climate Crisis and Corrupt Politics, Overcoming the Powerful Forces That Threaten Our Future. You're a longtime lover of the environment. You mentioned in the book that you looked out onto a very polluted Lake Erie as a teenager in the 1960s, and you decided to make the environment your life's purpose. But you say that your generation, which started the Earth Day movement and worked on environmental issues in the 70s and 80s, was ill-prepared for the highly organized corporate backlash in our efforts to curb climate change. What's an example of that pushback that you experienced in your career?
Well, the one that really stands out to me was in 2009, we were working on a bill called Cap and Trade. It was supported by both Republicans and Democrats early on, but then later became partisan because the oil and gas industry and the coal industry put enormous pressure on Republicans to back away from it.
So this was when you were the CEO of the National Wildlife Federation.
Yes. And I spent 10 years with National Wildlife as CEO, and my primary goal was to pass appropriate climate legislation. Back in those days, we only needed to cut carbon emissions by about 2% a year. Today, we're looking at 7.5% a year. And every year we wait, the challenge goes much steeper. So these interests have really prevented us from making real progress.
Several times in the book, you criticized the media for its part in the climate crisis. What could the media have done differently over the last decades, and what should it be doing now?
Well, give you one example. Currently, BP is running ads suggesting that their wind is helping to solve the problem. And the truth of the matter is I served on the Wind and Wildlife Advisory Committee years ago. And during that process, BP had a wind subsidiary. They had a CEO who was committed to beyond petroleum, if you remember. They coined that term for BP, beyond petroleum. Well, they were building wind turbines in those days and moving in a different direction. And he was fired. They brought in a new CEO. And since that time, BP has been going back to its old tricks. They've actually sold off some of their wind farms. They've closed down their wind operations in 2013, I believe it was. And they are no longer participating in the new energy economy. Instead, are continuing to develop oil offshore and in other places to market because they think that's where their future lies.
And you think the media is not doing a good job of covering this issue?
Well, they let them run these ads that are false, and they should not be allowed. Exxon is again running ads. They've been advertising that they're working on algae to produce biofuels. You know, give me a break. They've had that same narrative for decades, and they're not changing it. They know the evidence. Exxon has actually done some of the best early research in the 60s on climate change, and yet they suppress that evidence, and they've moved ahead ignoring their own scientists.
I was really fascinated by the part of your book where you talk about being on the scene of the BP oil spill in the Gulf. That was in 2010, largest oil spill in American history. You were with the National Wildlife Federation at that time, and you guys were hiring boats to get journalists out into the water so they could actually see the damage that was happening rather than sort of accept the company line about what kind of damage was being done to wildlife and to marine life.
Well, I was involved earlier in the Exxon Valdez spill, and I watched how Exxon masterfully manipulated the media. And so I got on a plane from Washington, D.C., flew down to New Orleans, went out to Venice, which is where the docks were that were headed out to the BP spill. And I found the media all interviewing BP employees to find out what's going on out there. And so I started talking to some of the people in the media, and they said, well, we don't have a budget for hiring boats. We haven't been out there. And so what we did is we went out and hired 5 to 7 watermen every day to take us out onto the water. And there were media from all over the world there. So we were hauling these folks out, helping to interpret what they were seeing and how it was impacting nature, how it was impacting the Gulf of Mexico. The government really turned the entire spill site over to BP. They actually gave them enforcement powers to arrest people who might enter into this area. They controlled the skies and they controlled the water. So that'd be a little bit like having a local police department turn the crime scene over to the criminal. So BP was controlling the game. That continued for weeks. Most of what you saw on television was filmed off of our boats that we had hired. And it was stopped incidentally by Dick Cheney's press secretary was hired by BP, and she came down and ended up buying off all the watermen, all but one, and shut down the media. So at a point, all of a sudden, it all stopped. And the media was then back to reporting secondhand stories.
You've worked with senators to try to pass climate legislation, work on cap and trade plans with environmentalists and heads of corporations, which are our carbon emitters. You know, a lot of this didn't go very far or didn't go anywhere. And you talk a little bit about in the book about your own failure. You say watching repeated climate denial from President Trump and Republicans in Congress, there are many days when I feel that 40 years of fighting for rational climate policies have been for naught. I don't make excuses and consider this to be a career-long failure. Do you feel like you've failed in that way?
Well, I do. I feel like the movement has failed. I feel like the American public has also failed us. We have tried very hard to get the baby boomers, for example, to understand that our children's future hangs in the balance. I have 5 grandsons, and I feel like their future has been gravely jeopardized by what we're facing today. I don't know a single grandparent. I don't know a single grandparent who would knowingly destroy their grandchildren's future. And yet that's exactly what we're doing if we fail to act on their behalf. And I think we need my generation needs to be accountable. We need to step forward and do our part to protect our children's future.
You know, while President Trump and his administration are denying climate change on a lot of levels and actively working on policies that do benefit the oil and gas industry, the Democratic candidates for president participated in a climate debate. You know, kids all over the country and the world are protesting inaction on climate change. And a Green New Deal has been proposed focusing on green jobs and renewable energy. And you write that you're heartened by the bold demands of the Green New Deal and other youth-driven efforts, but that you understand the uphill battle they'll face. What do you mean by that? And are these hopeful initiatives for you?
I believe that they are. I also believe that the next generation of leaders coming down need to understand what they're facing so that they can be more equipped to fight. You know, it's sort of like a football game. You know, if you know the strengths and weaknesses of your opponents, you're more apt to win the moment. And I wrote this book to help the next generation understand who they're competing with and why we've lost so that they can win. But I am heartened by it. And I'm also heartened by the idea that Senator Ed Markey and AOC have come together, 2 generations, to find a solution. And that's really what the Green New Deal is all about. It's about finding a solution or set of solutions that are big enough. You know, during the Second World War, my mother worked for American Bridge. And during that time, American Bridge shut down all of its normal operations and focused its entire operation on building the equipment and the supplies and material for the Second World War. And I think the same is true today. We need to reposition our entire economy in a warlike setting. We need to stop thinking it's business as usual. And really, all of us need to focus on solving this crisis, or we're not going to do it.
Well, what's your best advice to these sort of new, younger leaders in the environmental movement?
I think we will have a change election if we get every young person to not only register to vote, but to organize on their campuses, in their communities, to get others out to vote. voting turnout is really critical. This is a voter turnout election coming up next year. And so I can be very blunt about that. Unless we turn out large numbers of voters who care about the future, we will lose and we will be facing a terrible future, frankly.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Larry Schweiger is the author of The Climate Crisis and Corrupt Politics, Overcoming the Powerful Forces That Threaten Our Future. He says in retirement, he's doing pretty much what he did in his career, but without the paycheck. He helped his friend Al Gore start the Climate Reality Project to train climate communicators, and he's still working with them today in Pittsburgh.